Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the NBA podcast presented by B-Ball Breakdown. I'm Brian Toporek, and joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. How's it going, guys?
Going well. How are you guys doing?
Doing well, Bri and Sarah. How are you?
It's good to have you guys back. It's been a couple episodes.
Yeah, it has, but you had Jeff on instead, so that more than makes up for it, though. At least from my end.
That's true. Yeah. Another shout out to Jeff McMenamin at Sixers Blog on Twitter, who joined us last time to get my Jahlil Okafor rants out. So he spared you guys. Credit to him, too, because at the end of last episode, we previewed game two of the NBA Finals, and he suggested he expected a 20 some point blowout. And I thought he was crazy and scoffed at him. And then the Warriors scoffed at me and blew out the Cavaliers by 33 points. Even though Steph and Klay didn't find their offensive rhythm, Draymond Green led the way with 28 points, 7 rebounds, and 5 assists. He was 5 of 8 shooting from downtown. And the Warriors won 110-77, taking a 2-0 series lead. And honestly, it looked like the series was just about over heading back to Cleveland. But Wednesday night, in Game 3, the Cavaliers came out throwing some punches. They took a 33-16 advantage in the fourth quarter, and then ran that out to a 120-90 victory overall. So, from what I saw, it was the biggest swing in NBA Finals history in terms of consecutive blowouts for either team. Guys, did you expect the Cavaliers to come back like that in Game 3?
No. No, I didn't. I was trying to talk myself out of believing that it was going to be a sweep. So I definitely didn't expect. I didn't know that they were going to win. I was pretty sure they were going to drop both, hoping they'd win at least one. And certainly didn't expect a blowout. Not at all.
I expected beforehand, let me just wrap it up a little bit or start over a little bit, because here's the thing. When Kevin Love was announced out for the evening, that changed my prediction. I thought Golden State would come in, maybe struggle initially because it's a road game after all in the finals. There's some pressure, but I thought they'd prevail in the end. But as soon as I heard Love was out, I thought, okay, they're going to switch it up a little bit. And they might be considering Channing Frye, even Richard Jefferson. Then this morning I found out when I caught the game that, yep, they did indeed start Richard Jefferson. And I figured, like, if they had one of those guys in instead, they were going to be quicker, they were going to be more agile, and they were going to wreak havoc, like, defensively in a way they couldn't with Love there. So that changed my prediction, and I didn't know that they would win by 30, obviously, but I did, like, think they would take game three. But it's pretty crazy when an all-star player missing leads you to believe that the team is going to win.
Yeah, that's, well, I'm sure we'll talk a lot about K-Love today, because that's obviously the biggest storyline coming out of game three, is what the Cavaliers do with him, assuming he is cleared for game four and beyond. I'm with you, Morten. I expected the Cavs to come out and throw a good first punch in the first quarter. I also expected them, didn't expect a 30-point blowout just like you, but I did expect them to win. I wrote a piece at FanSided Wednesday morning about how if Love was forced to miss the game, it was going to force the Cavaliers to make really drastic adjustments, which I think you need to do after getting routed by 33 points. You know, you can't roll out the same starting five and say everything's okay, we just need to play harder. That was partially true, and the Cavaliers, you know, they did show a lot more effort, especially on defense, and they were more focused offensively in game three as well. But I think you can argue that was at least in part because of the lineup change. It seemed like there was a strategic adjustment to run a lot more pick and rolls with Kyrie and LeBron doing like 1-4 pick and rolls, which wasn't possible when Kevin Love was the starting four, obviously. So, yeah, let's just dive right into it. What happens with Kevin Love? It sounds like, according to Jason Lloyd of the Akron Beacon Journal, the Cavaliers are privately expecting that he's healthy in game four. can you go back to him as a starter?
No.
Yeah, I don't think so. And we talked about that, though. I mean, before the series even started, you know, you guys suggested perhaps he should come off the bench, but we didn't expect it would happen because of, you know, the talk that would surround that. But, yeah, it's going to be really tough to do now.
Yeah, this is like an Andrew Bogut situation, like from last year, except for the fact that last year was for spacing purposes.
Right.
And Love can actually stretch the court. He's just too damn slow to react defensively.
Yeah.
So it's a different scenario, but still the same outcome. But no, I don't think you can. And it seems like Tyronn Lue was kind of, you know, acknowledging that a little bit. He didn't cement that Love was going to start next game.
Right.
So he's keeping his options open, and I think that's the right play. Like, you're 0-2 in the finals with Love. You're 1-0 with Richard Jefferson. All right, fair enough. Small sample size and change of home court and all that, but still, they came out and blew away the Golden freaking State Warriors by 30 by switching up their schemes and having the ball go through the hands of Kyrie and LeBron. Mm-hmm. Here's another aspect that people don't talk about. Kevin Love has a tendency to stand with the basketball in his hands looking for passing angles, and it just slows down the clock and nothing happens. There is no motion there. With LeBron and Kyrie handling the ball, you see them moving, you see them cutting, you see them have some sort of dribble activity. Basically, it keeps the defense on their toes at all times, leading to better shots. That's what I want to see from Cleveland.
Yeah, so I agree with you guys that they should not start Kevin Love. I don't know that they have the courage to actually do that, because Rachel Nichols of ESPN tweeted out a picture earlier today of Kevin Love at practice, and he is wearing a red starter's jersey, that's how we got tipped off yesterday at shoot-around, that Richard Jefferson was probably going to be starting. He was wearing the same red starter's jersey. So it seems like the Cavs are planning on putting Love back in the starting lineup if he is cleared, which it sounds like they're expecting.
But you could easily make the excuse that, you know, oh, he's coming back from concussion, we're just going to kind of limit him a little bit and bring off the bench. Like, that would be so easy to do, at least this first time.
So, yeah, I would think so, too. I mean, I think the evidence is there. Like, you had such success with LeBron starting at the four, so he can start on Draymond. I mean, Draymond was the key to the huge rout in game two. Like, Curry hasn't shot well at all this entire series, but if you let Draymond be a playmaker, you're still going to get buried. And it seems like with LeBron on Draymond right to start, like that Curry-Green pick and roll, which gave Cleveland so much trouble in the first two games, they really contained that a lot better in game three. So I don't think you could go back to Love, but it seems like they're going to.
Well, that's good. Then Golden State will clinch on their home court
in
game five. They didn't do that last year, so.
Yeah,
no, but
it's a favor from Tyronn Lue.
Another note, right? I'm looking at the seasons or the series stats right now. Do y'all think that Steve Kerr might be a little too lax with the minutes, like playing his bench a little bit too much? I'm looking right now, and for the series, Klay Thompson is averaging less than 29 minutes a game, and Stephen Curry is just over 30. Now, I know they sat a lot last night because of the blowout, but still, I mean, I would like to see him leave them in a little bit further in these finals, maybe to create a push. Like, there was a point in time where they started to make a run a little bit, and they started feeling a little bit confident, and then he went to the bench again, and I don't know, man. When I'm thinking about it, I would probably play these guys 40-plus just to see what could happen. That shooting stroke could be located in an instant, and if there's a team out there that can run off 15-20 points in 3 or 4 minutes, it's the Warriors. I kind of feel like it's a wasted opportunity.
It's funny that you say that, because last night I was thinking there's like 7-6 minutes to go, and Curry was still in, and I'm thinking, why the hell is he still running around out there? But I hadn't really noticed like their minutes as a whole. So it's a good point that you make, that they could possibly find their rhythm. Maybe all these blowouts are not helping them do that. It's such a tricky thing, though, for coaches. Yeah.
No, I get that. I'm just thinking when you don't have your shooting touch going, like Klay Thompson right now is at 37% shooting. Mm-hmm. I would actually say fair enough. You keep them in there, even though it's a little bit of mop up duty. Just locate that shot, get the legs going, find your rhythm, carry it on into next game. But you know that's why I'm not an NBA coach.
Seemed like he did do that. I mean, Curry was so bad in the first half of game three. And then in the third quarter, it seemed like he started to find his stroke a little bit. And it yeah. was like they were still down 20 and he was cutting the lead to like 18 and then 15 and the Cavs would push right back. So it did seem like he might have found something that was working a little bit more than he did, at least in the first half. And a similar thing happened last year. Like he was awful in game two. And that was when Matthew Dellavedova became the Curry stopper. I think he was like 5 of 23, I want to say, like Kobe Bryant type efficiency. And then it was, again, like really bad in the first three quarters of game three. And then the fourth quarter, it seemed like you found something. And that was when David Lee came in as the small ball five, and they were using him to open up Curry on screens. So I'm not sure if that third quarter eruption from Steph was a sign of things to come or it was just like kind of a flash in the pan. I mean, I do think game two, you know, you're up 25, 30 points. You're trying to preserve your guys. Like there's no point in putting Curry in there, even though he's not playing super well. I think he still was 7 of 11 in game two, had 18 points in like 25 minutes. So that was his best outing. And again, like the last thing you want, Morton, you of all people should know this, the last thing you want in the blowout of a playoff game is to have your star in there for the last minute and then you know something catastrophic happens and swings the whole balance of the series.
Well, you see, I'm a tips guy, you know. I love tips. I don't fault tips for doing that back in the day. I mean, I you know, I like the fact that he uses the last minutes to kind of achieve something going forward. And I agree with you that the game two blowout, that's fair because you're winning, take them out.
Yeah.
But in Cleveland, where you're in hostile territory, the baskets are a little bit different, the colors in the background are different, you can't really find your touch. Then I think there is some merit to leaving them out there just a little bit longer to just find something they can build on. Because as we have heard from NBA players since the dawn of time is, it's all about confidence. Mm. It's all about seeing that first shot, second shot, third shot go down and then build from there. And I do think that you're right, Ryan, that Steph found something in third quarter that he might be able to carry over. But in that case, I still would want Klay out there because holy hell, it's been bad. And he was like an MVP candidate going into the series, like a finals MVP candidate.
And we saw during the Oklahoma City series, I mean, how quickly things can turn. Like, Steph was really bad for most of that series, and then Klay caught fire in game six, and then Steph kind of drove the final dagger in, and then in game seven, he was phenomenal, and it was, you know, all of us thought, like, oh, Steph's healthy again. there goes that MCL thing. I mean, we've been talking about this, but can we touch on, like, what's going on with Steph right now? Is it a schematic thing? Is it a health thing? Is it just like a fluky, he's just missing open shots that he normally hits?
Voodoo?
I want to clarify that I wasn't laughing about Rose's injury, but Morton's face when you went there, Brian, was pretty awesome. So that was it.
He just took me back 4 years to my life's worst nightmare. That's uncool, Brian.
Sorry. I mean, I just had to make that point. You don't play, play your guys when you're up 20 in the end of a blowout that you're in favor of.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Well, as far as Steph, Steph and Klay, I mean, we're probably not giving enough credit to how much that series with Oklahoma could take out of players, mm-hmm. especially the two of them. It required Herculean effort from them. But with Steph in particular, you know, this has kind of been going on for a while. That went on in the beginning of that series. So it's a good question, and I don't really know. Could, you know, yeah, we keep going back and forth. Is he hurt? Is he? He's not hurt. Now he's fine. I don't know. It could be some lingering issues, ankle, knee. You know, that could be running all up and down his leg. but we really don't know. I don't want to give him an out, but yeah, he certainly doesn't look like the guy that we've seen all year, and until he does for flashes of Game 7. So I don't know.
He's playing like trash. He's really playing like trash. He has a combined 25 turnovers and fouls this series compared to 28 combined rebounds and assists.
Wow.
I mean, it's really bad. I mean, he's 15 turnovers for the series. Like, the second leading, you know, ball loser is, yeah, that's both Draymond and Klay with 6. So he's +9 in the turnovers department than any of his teammates. And I believe it's +2 in the fouls department. It's like, yeah, he's the only guy on the team with double digits in turnovers and fouls for this series. And he's picking up the cheap ones.
Yeah.
One thing is taking a hard foul and really sticking it to him, but he's picking up the cheap ones. And that's not him usually. And it seems like when he does it, he's pretty hard on himself. You see the camera zoom in on him and he's like shaking his head, looking down, and he's looking over to Steve. Steve is looking back at him, shaking his head like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
He's playing timid basketball, which isn't Steph at all. But I don't have an answer. It seems pretty coincidental. With Klay, I just think he's missing. I think Klay's activity and movement is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
I just think he's not finishing his shots. Like, when he's going in for layups, he's putting too much force on the ball, so it just bounces off the rim, and the shots, they're just not dropping right now. If he has one game, like one of those Game 6 in Oklahoma games, you know, he's back. Then he's back.
Yeah.
But one of them needs that game. One of them needs to have that one breakout game, like Kyrie and LeBron had last night.
Yeah, Steph, I think it's just, we have to be nuanced here. I think it's a combination of his health. Like, he pulled out of the Olympic team on Monday, and he cited his knee and ankle injuries. So I don't think he's not going to be fully healthy until he has weeks off to recover. Like, what percent of health he is, like, that was, you know, a big topic in OKC. It was 91.2% tonight. That doesn't really matter because everyone's kind of banged up. He's more banged up than most guys probably, but, you know, no one is operating at 100% efficiency right now. But I think, you know, we saw it with Dwayne Wade back when the Heatles were at full power and his knees were giving him problems. Like, he had a lot of bad games, and then he had a couple good games. And it's just kind of like hit or miss. Like, if your knee is bothering you that night, especially if you're a three-point shooter and you rely on your lower body to generate that power, even the slightest tweak is going to throw you off, especially when you're, like, as regimented a shooter as Steph, and you're taking these stupid, like, 28-foot three-point shots. So I think health is definitely part of it. I also, like, credit to Cleveland, especially last night. They played him well. And they've made a concerted effort, even in the first two games. They were trapping him on pick and rolls. They were just, like, not giving him the airspace to launch those threes because they know that's what gets that whole team rolling. When he's hitting those, not even just, like, normal three-pointers, but his, like, stupid shots that no one else has any business making. And that like, gets the Oracle crowd roaring. So they made a concerted effort not to let him get those shots. They were trapping him. They were doubling him. They were leaving Dre wide open. Dre didn't make him pay for it in Game 1, but he did in Game 2. So it seemed like they switched their strategy a little bit in Game 3, didn't trap as much, mostly just switched, which we can go back to the Kevin Love stuff. Like, I think him being out allowed them to do that a little bit better. But I just think their Cleveland's defense deserves credit. Just like, you know, OKC last series, it was like, are the Warriors just playing really bad or are the Thunder playing really well? Like, I think after watching the Warriors blow out the Cavs in the first two games, let's go back to the OKC choke narrative. Like, no, they didn't. They were playing really freaking well against a really historically great team. So I think, you know, Cleveland deserves similar credit for how they handled Steph last night.
Yeah. You know what Cleveland is doing? They're playing whack-a-mole defense. And by that, I mean when you play whack-a-mole, you have to, like, anticipate which one is coming up next.
Yeah.
So they're trying to... this is, like, different warriors in the whack-a-mole holes. And they're like, okay, last time around, we know that, Steph, he's the guy who's going to be hot this game. Whack him. Okay, now it's Draymond. Whack him. Like, they know exactly when or when, you know, someone is bound to step up. It seems mm-hmm. like they are at least choosing the right player to zero in on at the beginning of games. I will say that Draymond's game two, I was really thinking it was unsustainable.
Yeah.
Because
oh yeah,
that's not, you know, Draymond isn't like this high profile scorer.
Right.
But I didn't anticipate he would be that timid in game three though.
Yeah. What did he did? Wasn't he a plus? I wanted to say he was. Oh no, just kidding. Oh, no one was a plus in the starting lineup, but he was the least of the minuses. He was only a minus 15, and he was the only Warrior starter to be less than a minus 20. So
well, that's good.
Yeah, he played a little bit better. It's 6 points, 7 rebounds, 7 assists, 2 of 8 shooting, 0 of 4 from three. It seemed like they didn't give him the same type of wide open shots that they were giving him in games one and two. And I noticed, LeBron seemed to be the culprit for a lot of that stuff. Like, he just would not close out at all. Even when they would swing it to Dre and he would, like, hesitate for a second and LeBron would just kind of stare at him with, like, doe eyes and just be like, well, I think that was their strategy, was just goad him into these shots because, as you said, Morton, he's not a high efficiency scorer, especially from 3-point range. But then once he made them pay in game two, Lou said, okay, we can't, you know, we're down 2-0. We can't leave dudes wide open anymore. We just need to give more of an effort defensively. Yeah. Did you guys notice any other schematic changes last night that contributed to what Cleveland did to the Warriors?
Outside of the switching with JR, with RJ, I just basically noticed that the game was going through the offense was going through the hands of LeBron and Kyrie more, like I touched upon earlier, and that J.R. Smith could easier play off of that instead of like with Love there. Mm-hmm. It seemed like he was doing the Reggie Miller last night, running around, just trying to get open shots. That was like a semi half-hearted attempt in games one and two.
Yeah.
But here in game three, it was like a concerned effort from the Cavs to seek him out and get him going, as well as keeping their own ball movement going. But, you know, outside of that, it was just like more intensity, I think. They made shots is really a key difference, though. I mean, we shouldn't underestimate it. Kyrie took a bunch of shots that he took like the same caliber of in Oakland.
Right.
But just made them here. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. so that goes a long way.
And it's more of a product of the switching that you guys talked about. But, yeah, they just looked a lot better on defense. Kyrie, specifically, at certain points, was, you know, up on Steph. He was meeting him at the three-point line instead of falling behind or falling asleep or losing focus. That's huge. And this isn't a difference, I don't think. They do this a lot. But, in particular, I like how they post LeBron, like, at the elbow. Mm-hmm. Because he has more space to drive it if he wants to face up and drive, but it also kind of cuts out the angle. We know the Warriors guards are so good at coming down to dig and surprising whoever's posting up and knocking the ball away, and it kind of eliminates that. So I'd like to see maybe if the Spurs might want to try that next year a little bit more if we're going to build our offense around post-ups. But of course you need shooters to put around them, that helps, but yeah, I like that little wrinkle because, yeah, it cuts that out and it's a lot harder for those guards to get in there and muck everything up.
I think Tyronn Lue heard the JJ Redick podcast with Tracy McGrady because Tracy was actually talking about putting LeBron the elbow a whole lot more.
Oh, interesting. He was
talking about it for a long while, talking about the benefits of it, how easy it was to get to the rim that way because you only had to take like one dribble. It was pretty interesting to listen to. And Ty played with Tracy in Orlando, I believe. So, you know, he might have picked up his old teammate's podcast on JJ Redick and thought, oh, hey, there's a nugget I can use. But that's just me speculating, obviously. But yeah, it worked. And to be frank, like this is old school Kobe stuff, by the way. Kobe yeah. always went to the elbow. And I know for back in the 28-29, you know, season, or yeah, 08-09 season, Kobe actually gave the same advice to Derrick Rose and Russell Westbrook as rookies. He told them, guys, stick close to the elbow, like, you know, go with the back to the basket and then get at the elbow, and because you can see the whole court, and if they back up off of you, you can just pull up. So it's interesting to see that is in effect.
Yeah, it seemed like, Sarah, that point you brought up about the Warriors not really slapping the ball away in the post, you're right. Like, I didn't see that nearly as much in Game 3. Like, that was a huge thing in Game 2, especially Andre Iguodala, I think, had, like, two or three consecutive possessions where LeBron would go to the basket and then try to go up, and Iggy slapped it away from him and forced a transition opportunity. And then LeBron naturally, like, cried to the referees and said, "Where's my foul?" And then didn't actually run back, creating a 5-on-4, which is just give the Warriors 2 or 3 points right there. So that's a really good point. I wrote a piece at B-Ball Breakdown about Kyrie and how great he was in Game 3. And Morton, you're right. Like, he was taking the same shots. Like, a lot. I mean, he had 16 points in the first quarter. Most of those came on isolation. Like isolation mid and long range jump shots. So they weren't necessarily any different than the type of shots he was taking in the first two games. He did use Mozgov well to free him up for two open threes at the end of the quarter. But, like, there was one possession where he just kind of shake and baked Steph. Like, it was just the two of them, and then he did a couple of crossovers and pulled up and drained an 18-footer in his face. So I don't know if it was, like, a schematic thing or if he was just shooting with more confidence. You know, going into the game, he talked about being more aggressive and being more decisive and not dribbling the air out of the ball. But
yeah,
just taking shots, you know, they're going to be contested. Like, that's the thing about the Warriors. You have to hit contested shots against them. Like, you're not going to get a plethora of open looks like the ones the Cavaliers were gifting to the Warriors in games 1 and 2. So you need to be willing to take quote-unquote bad shots. And it's just a matter of if you hit them or not.
Iverson shots, basically.
Yeah. Hey, now.
Yeah. No. I know. I'm sorry. I know he's your boy and all. But look, it's the type. There is an element, I should say, to Kyrie's game that resembles AI.
For sure.
Like, when the going gets tough or when they're down, he is the type of guy who can, you know, manufacture shots out of thin air, even if they're contested. Like, if he goes 2 of 5, then at least he keeps some sort of life in it. And he's that type of guy, you know? And what he did last night was much necessary. Like, I mean, 30 points on 25 shots, it's not because it's uber efficient or anything, but they needed this.
Right.
They needed this push, you know? So, no, I get it. I totally get that.
Yeah, he actually wasn't. So I think he was 7 of 9 in the first quarter, and then he was only 5 of 16 for the rest of the game. So he actually wasn't super efficient, especially after the first quarter. But, I mean, through the games 1 and 2, he had 6 turnovers compared to 5 assists. Game 3 alone, he had 8 assists.
Yeah.
And game 2, he had 1. And there was that game, like, I think it was it this year or the last year, where he had 1 assist and LeBron James, after the game, said, "You can never do that again." And then he did it in a finals game. So it seemed like the Cavs were making a concerted effort to get him involved not only as a scorer but as a playmaker as well.
Well, he would kind of have to be as well. Like, he's their lead guard.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, and besides, that would just be putting too much pressure on LeBron to just do everything, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they finally discovered that LeBron has to go Draymond on Draymond.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so if they add that ball handling duty to his responsibility, you know, there's, I mean, then it becomes obvious that he's tired and can't really do everything. Speaking of LeBron, by the way, Are we all in agreement that his game last night was a big F you to Andre Iguodala?
Oh, yeah.
All right, just checking, because I felt that. When I sat there and watched the game, I was like, yeah, he's proving a point right now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, because a lot of people were saying, like, Iggy's got his number, basically. Like, I think I saw somewhere, I forget who tweeted this, but I think it was Tom Haberstroh, maybe, that this was LeBron's first finals game as a Cavalier where he shot above 50%.
Oh. That sounds right. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, so it seemed like he definitely, I'm pretty sure he was sick of hearing how well Iggy was shutting him down. But he also needed that complimentary effort from Kyrie and from J.R. Smith, who had 20 points. I mean, that was the game swinger, in my opinion. Like, because he had just been so bad in the games 1 and 2 in Oracle. So for him to come out, I think he had, did he have like 9 shot attempts in total in games 1 and 2? And then he had 10 three-point attempts alone in game 3. Like, he needs to, it goes back to what I was saying, like, you need to take bad shots against the Warriors because they're going to take bad shots against you. They're just going to hit them. So if you return the favor, like, you know, the Cavs came into this series talking about how they were going to match pace with the Warriors and try to outshoot them. That's suicide. You don't do that. But if you can outshoot them on bad shots, that starts to make things a little more even because they're going to take bad shots against you.
But it's not sustainable, though.
That's true. So, yeah, that's the question. Can J.R. Smith do this not only even in Game 4, but they still need to steal a game on the road? Can he do this in Oracle?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I think he can, but I don't think that he, LeBron, and Kyrie at the same time can have the same sort of impacts that they had last night. I don't think that trio can be as effective going forward in the same game. I think it would have to be more spread out. Or not have to be, sorry, but I think it's going to be more spread out, whereas it would have to be like last night. And I don't think that's going to be the case, especially when they hit Oracle.
I would have to agree. I mean, I think what JR did, he could do that again, especially because they kind of got him going with a combination of, you know, it starts with the Kyrie Thompson pick and roll or the Kyrie LeBron, and Kyrie just being aggressive off of that, and he got the defense moving. So they got him a wide open shot early, and then, you know, they turned the Warriors over. That's always been a weakness for the Dubs that exists. They turned them over 18 times, I think. They got out in transition. The ball was moving. I remember one break. I don't know if it was Kyrie, but, you know, the ball went to JR in the corner. He passed it back out, then went back down to him. He was wide open for 3. So they got it going with the good looks. And then he can hit those where, you know, Iguodala is standing right in his face and he just throws it up. You know, but that's how he got started. It was actually some good looks. So they can do that again. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be difficult to have all 3 of them go off again. It's not likely, but it could happen. could happen. But yeah, in Oracle, it's going to be really, really tough, obviously.
One note. Now we've kind of dissected game 3, right? No one has mentioned rebounding, and that's kind of...
Go in there next, Morton.
It's kind of curious, right? Because I'm not just talking about us. I'm talking about generally, because when Golden State played Oklahoma City, it was all about rebounding and, you know, oh, they're big and they're large, and they're hitting the glass, and it becomes apparent, but for some reason, it flew completely under the radar that Cleveland was plus 20 on the boards.
Last night, yeah.
That's one of the notes I made, too. I mean, yeah, this you have to. Like we said with OKC, you have to out-rebound them. You have to turn them over if you're going to have a chance. Just have to.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. And it seems like Golden State is missing that one rebounder coming off the bench. Like, you know, we had this conversation some months back about a very decent rebounder who's going to be available this summer. Like, I think Thomas Robinson would be so good in Golden State. Like, he's the type of guy you can just, if they can sign him somehow, and he can come in and just board the crap out of that ball.
Brian, I'm going to ask you to delete that part out of this podcast. Let's not give them any ideas, please.
Yeah, because you want him on
Morton, that is a great idea, though. My God.
Yeah. That would be really, I mean, you could probably get him for the mid-level.
Yeah, exactly, right? And he could come in, like, if he's given 15, 18 minutes, he couldn't average 6-7 rebounds, high percentage of contested.
Yeah, because I think, like, Mo Spates is a free agent after this year, right?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if he has another year. No, I think he's a free agent. I think so, yeah.
So you're going to, theoretically, going to need to replace him, possibly Festus as well. Like, you might need an entirely new front court rotation off the bench next year.
Possibly, yeah. I could see Mo stick around, though, for cheap.
Yeah.
He seems to really love it there. And, yeah. And he, look, this is like the one place where he can get the green light.
I know.
Whenever he comes in, it's like, he looks at Steve, and Steve just go.
Yep.
Just go. You know, I think he loves that. I think he appreciates that. I he's probably going to say, you know what? I'm going to stick around. I can shoot threes.
Yeah, here. Right. This is the one team where I actually will get to be able to shoot threes. And Steve Kerr, they were down like 27-10 last night, I want to say. And then he turned to Spates and said, go, give us some offense. And then he hit a three right away. So, yeah, I have a feeling he probably sticks around too. But I'm glad you brought up the rebounding. Before the series started, shameless plug, I wrote a thing at B-Ball Breakdown about how Cleveland needs to dominate the glass. In the Western Conference Finals, the three games that OKC won, they had a rebounding margin of +8 or better. So without significantly out-rebounding the Warriors, they lost every time when it was close or if the Warriors out-rebounded them. I just wrote a thing at today's Fast Break, actually, about Tristan Thompson, who is going to be the unsung hero of Game 3, in my opinion. So the Warriors, as a team, had 8 offensive rebounds last night. Tristan had 7. You guys said it; they out-rebounded him 52-32 overall. They had second-chance points. It was 23-3 in favor of Cleveland. And in the first two games, it was pretty evenly matched. I think it was 15-13 Warriors in Game 1 and then 15-13 Cavs in Game 2. They won the points in the paint battle. I think it was 54-32. The Warriors won that the first two games. So I think that's the key for Cleveland moving forward. You need to control the paint. You need to out-rebound them in the paint. You need to outscore them in the paint. You need to dominate because that's your advantage. You have the size to bully them, especially, you know, I think we could throw this question out there. Andrew Bogut's been pretty bad in this series, so you have to wonder, are they going to switch to the death lineup in Game 4? And if they do, then Cleveland, like, now it's even more imperative to out-rebound them, because if they get out in transition, you're dead.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting note that you have to score near the rim, because that would actually suggest that Kevin Love still has a role to play. It seems they are really going away from that. Like, he can score in the post. This right. is not, like, it seems like he's just, I've used this term a lot, I think, on this podcast as well. Kevin Love on Cleveland is playing like a glorified Al Harrington.
Yes.
Like, I mean, I want to see Kevin be Kevin. Like, get offensive rebounds, put backs, get near the basket, run some elbow stuff. It's just not happening. So, yeah, you're right. If they can maximize their efforts in getting scoring around the rim and while cleaning up the glass, yeah, they have a shot. They would have to get LeBron into Miami Heat mode, though. Like, when he got near the rim, like, on every possible possession and backed everyone down. It seems like he's become a little bit more perimeter-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Not in terms of long-range shooting, but like that 16-17 pull-up J. Mm-hmm. Is it just me? I mean, this is, I haven't even read any stats on it. It's just like an eyeball thing. Is it me, or does it look like he's taking more of those pull-ups?
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed like, well, so in the second quarter, he really seemed like he was trying to attack the basket, and he just wasn't effective. Like, he was not hitting those shots. But then Tristan was coming through. He had 6 offensive rebounds in the second quarter alone. Golden State had 0 that quarter. And that's when the game really busted open for Cleveland. Like, when the Warriors cut it to 9 a couple times, and it was like, oh my god, are the Cavs really about to blow a 20-point lead at home? And Tristan really helped stymie any momentum Golden State had. Like, LeBron would throw something up around the rim, miss, Trista would grab the offensive rebound and throw down a putback dunk or draw a foul. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. So we all said earlier that Kevin Love can't start, but do you guys think he's useless in this series? Is it like a Bogut situation last year where he just should not even see the court for the next couple games? Or does he have a role off the bench?
I mean, it's Kevin Love. Of course he has some sort of role. It's just, it's about defining it, right? Mm-hmm. It seems like with Kevin in Cleveland, it's just they threw him out there saying, hey, you're a star, go be a star. It seems undefined. He just lurks around the three-point line so much, and he doesn't move his feet a whole lot defensively, and then people, you know, key in on that. We do too.
Right.
But, I mean, he's insanely skilled and has a raw talent that's just mind-boggling, honestly. So, yeah, there's a role for him. They just need to find it. They just need to understand how to use him. And, look, I can come up with some half-baked idea of putting him in the post like I did moments ago, but yeah, I don't know if that's going to work. I don't know if it's going to work putting him at the elbow. I don't know if the best possible outcome you can have is actually doing what you do now with having him lurking around the three-point line. I don't know, but that's up to Tyronn Lue and the coaching staff to find a way to utilize Kevin Love, because you can use the skill set. You can use the talent. You just need to funnel it the right way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that I think you have to find a way to use, like Morton said, his skill set. It is going to be difficult defensively, but like you suggested, Brian, if you bring him off the bench perhaps and don't share a lot of time with him and Kyrie,
yeah,
maybe it's a little easier to kind of hide that one defensive vulnerability at a time,
right?
Especially too if Kyrie keeps playing better defense. Like, he actually looked good at times last night on defense. It's like, where has that been? But yeah, I don't know if you just use him off the bench, kind of overlap his minutes with LeBron, though, a little bit, post LeBron at the elbow and stick him in around the three-point line, Love and a bunch of other shooters. That could work. I would love to see him be able to score points in the paint, but it's hard to post Gold State for some reason. It's so damn difficult because, especially on the block, because, like I said, the guards are going to come down and dig. Mm-hmm. It's too slow. It slows down your entire offense to back down from that angle. And Draymond is such a pain.
Yeah.
So I think you try it to see what kind of luck he has against Draymond. But if he's not getting anywhere, you have to try something else.
Yeah, I think you nailed it, Sarah. The problem with him in the starting lineup is he and Kyrie are both liabilities unless Kyrie plays like he did last night.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot have two defensive liabilities on the floor against Golden State, particularly their starting lineup. Like, they just have too many shooters, too many open looks, too many playmakers. Like, Dre, Clay, and Steph can all really swing the ball around very well. And even Bogut's a pretty good passer for a big man. So I think you definitely need to do Love off the bench with, like, Delly and with Shumpert, with LeBron as much as possible. Ideally, I'd say you put him at the five off the bench and then match him with Festus or with Spates or Bogut if he's out there. Ideally, you're keeping him away from Draymond Green, but you know that whoever he's guarding, the Warriors going to target in pick and rolls. So I think it comes down more there to schematic things. I don't think you can trap. I think you just need to, as much as you stagger his minutes with Kyrie, I think you do the same thing with Curry. Like, you need to really limit his exposure to Stephen Curry.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they run a pick and roll and he gets switched on to Steph, he's dead. I mean, that we talked about that ad nauseum throughout, before the series started, the first two games, etc. Like, that's a well-known fact. He's just not able to hang with Steph or with Clay or with any of these guards. So I think there is a role for him. And the thing, I know this narrative is already percolating that, you know, he's a $100 million player. You can't play him for only 15 minutes a night, that kind of thing. But Bogut made a similar sacrifice last year in games 4 through 6. Like, he didn't play a single second in those games. And that won them the title. So if Love is willing to embrace this smaller role and goes up to Tyronn Lue and says, look, man, we played really well with Richard Jefferson in the starting lineup. Like, I don't care about my minutes. I don't care about my role. I'll play 10 minutes, but if it helps our team win, that's fine. Or if I'm getting roasted, like, pull me the hell out. Don't let my pride, my ego get in the way of the team. I don't know if he does that, but if he does, I think he deserves credit for doing so, much like Bogut got last year.
Well, obviously. I mean, yeah, you would have to be a fool to not credit him for that. Sure.
But I mean, I don't know if he gets that credit, even if he does do that, because his contract is so big.
No, I don't think it's about his contract. I think it's because of the Cleveland bias, you know, or, yeah. or anti-Cleveland bias, whatever you want to call it. Like, let's just face it. Cleveland is a team that many people in America dislike because of the presence of LeBron James. And if LeBron James is on the roster, everyone else is viewed as negative players, people, whatever. It's dreadfully unfair. It's completely and utterly ridiculous, but that's how people, you know, choose to perceive it. And so it just ignore the people who wouldn't give Love credit if that happens. Like, of course you would deserve credit.
Mm-hmm.
While on the subject of Love, by the way, here's a very half-baked, like quarter-baked idea of mine. Let's say he does come off the bench, right? I would actually pair him with Mo Williams instead of Matthew Dellavedova, because it seems like Mo is a little bit more explosive. He can pull up, and he doesn't like need everything served for him. He can you know, go for a pick and roll, pull up for three. He's a little bit more of a dynamic scorer. He can shoot, stretch, all that. And then I want to see like Kevin coming off the bench being the main feature player when he enters the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, go use Minnesota sets for all I care, just to give him the same shots that he got in Minnesota. Like, basically, let him go Mo Spates on it. I mean, seriously, just like, hey, Kevin, go in and be Mo Spates. You've got the green light. Like, whatever you want to do. Like, right. You know, if you want to mix it up a little bit like you did in Minnesota, like, take an elbow jump shot, follow that up with a post hook, get a handoff and pull up from free. By the way, that was a very underrated play that they ran in Minnesota with Nikola Pekovic and Kevin Love. Like,
mm-hmm.
Pekovic would hold the ball on top of the key. Love would sprint out to it, just get the handoff, and he would pull the F up and just drain it. That was a good play, and I've not seen that being utilized a whole lot in Cleveland, and that was a play that he did well. So I want to see Love get a little bit more of his mojo going. Like, just give him the green light, make him feel comfortable off the bench, and whatever happens, happens. Like, if he sucks, you know, Ty can pull him. So be it. I just want to see them at least try to unleash the love. Spread the love, man.
That should be the title of their championship DVD if they end up winning.
Unleash the love. Hey, you know, I said it first. Patent.
We got a year, folks. All right. Do you guys have any other major topics we should touch on before I get your predictions for game four?
Well, one, Harrison Barnes
is
actually looking fairly decent right now. And, you know, it only takes one team, right? I mean, prior to this series, I was like, and I'm still not inclined to believe that he's a max player. I don't think he's a max player. I think he's going to be drastically overpaid.
Right.
But now, you know, because he's performing in the finals, some team is going to say, well, he's stepping up on the biggest stage. He's a basketball player.
Don't you say it.
I haven't said anything. I just said that some team out there is probably looking at him and saying he's a basketball player and we need basketball players. I'm not saying anything else, Brian, but yeah.
The Sixers are too busy trading Nerlens Noel for a Jeff Teague coming off of a patellar tear. So they're...
And then following that up with Barnes. Yeah. And you have a cheap Barnes offseason and they're going to be like, yeah, we did it. We cashed in big time. That's how we use assets.
I'm going to move. I'm just going to leave the country if that happens. Yeah, that's
You can leave the country anyway. It's Hillary versus Trump, man.
That's true. That's the Barnes thing is a good point, because he actually did play really well in Game 3. He was like one of their lone bright spots. I think he had the most rebounds of any Warrior, if I remember correctly. And he was actually, especially in the second quarter, when Tristan was just dominating the offensive glass, he was actually coming down with some pretty contested rebounds. So
yeah,
yeah, I was impressed by... you know, I think the thing with Barnes is he just doesn't seem to have – he's kind of like Andrew Wiggins in a way. Like, he doesn't seem to have that mentality of a true number one scorer. And even if you put him on a bad team, I don't think he will. But he can affect the game in a lot of other ways. Like, he's very athletic. He does have, like, some rebounding chops. So he just needs to do that more. Like, he needs to just know his role. It's kind of like Andre Iguodala could be doing a lot more, but he knows his role on this Warriors team, and that won him a Finals MVP. So, but I mean, Barnes, no matter what he does, he's getting a max deal this year. So,
just... But that's so weird, though. Like, would you rather have Matt Barnes on a max deal or Kent Bazemore for $16 million a year? Or 17, whatever he's going to get. Like, that's probably going to be in that area between 15 and 18. I would much rather have Kent Bazemore.
Yeah, just because I don't see a huge difference in terms of what they'll provide. And I think the salary differences alone would...
Exactly. More money for Thomas Robinson.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, no. good call on Barnes there. All right, so game four prediction. Sarah, who do you have and why?
I think it's going to be a close game.
Let's hope.
Yes, let's. Man, I think I have to go Dubs in a close one. Hopefully, fingers crossed. We gotta believe that Steph and Clay are gonna get going at some point, right?
Yeah.
They have to. And I don't know if Kyrie and JR are gonna replicate their performance. I hope that Kyrie remains aggressive, because you know that's one of the things that I mentioned to you in our finals preview, which I would brag about, but it doesn't take a genius to say that he has to play well and be aggressive for them to have a chance. So, yeah. I don't know. I like, Steph's body language is worrying me, though. And you did mention that. But he's still capable of the magic. So, yeah, I'm going to go with them in a close one.
Morton, how about you?
Oh, man. I'm really tense about this, because I actually had three solid predictions
to open this phone. Can't blow this one. Pressure's on.
No, that's really, I mean, honestly, on my Danish Facebook page, no need to follow, guys. It's all in Danish. You wouldn't understand anything anyway. I actually made some prediction for the first three games of the series, and I've been catching lightning in a bottle. It's really been, like, unique. I've really hit on it, like, the game flow and everything. So if I come up with a prediction now, there's, like, a whole bunch of pressure on me right now. But you know what? I'm going to settle with saying three is good enough. So if I mess this one up, it's going to be okay.
That's true.
So I'm going to piggyback on Sarah's comment about Golden State's two guys there. They're going to step up eventually, and that would be the next game.
Yeah.
Side note, I said Dubs in six, and even after getting blown out by 30, I'm actually going to change my prediction to five instead of six.
Wow.
Because I still think, for some reason, you know, if they could take that, the next one. When I looked at those guys, even though I'm kind of skeptical of Steph right now, they had those moments, right? Where they got back and they were like, okay, we're just a couple of crazy threes away from them taking over. They were right there a couple of times.
Yeah.
So I think game four is the return of the Stephen Curry show. And I think game four is also the return of Klay Thompson looking human again.
Mm.
And they're going to win. And I think my biggest prediction here is I think they're going to win comfortably.
Interesting. Have those guys had, I guess, game seven in the Western Conference Finals? Like, have those guys gone nuclear at the same time? Or has it been like one guy is like just, you know, hot as the
sun? More or less one guy, but I think one of them is going to go nuclear and the other, he's just going to be like normal hot.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm with you guys. I do think the Warriors win. I'm impressed with what Cleveland did, but I am supremely worried that they put Kevin Love back in the starting lineup. And I just think, you know, that you had to expect a LeBron James-led team was not going to get swept. Like, you know, the 2007 team against the Spurs, that was a different story, because if you look at that roster, it is a tire fire. But this roster has a lot of talent. There was no way he was going to get swept with the final two games on his home court. You had to figure game three was their best chance to steal a game, because if, you know, if you're down 3-0 and you steal a game, it really doesn't matter. You still know you're going to get crushed, but now there's at least a little bit of hope. I mean, I think the Warriors, they might have gotten a little complacent after that game two blowout. I think if the blowout was in game one and the closer game was in game two, last night might have been a little bit of a different story. I think the Cavaliers still win, but probably not by 30. So, yeah, I think I just feel like the Warriors are going to come out a little more hungry in game four, because they know, you know, we missed our chance to really basically close out the series. But if we go up 3-1 on them, going back to Oracle for game five, like we know what's going to happen in that game. And they did not close out last year's, they closed out in Cleveland. So I think they want to do it in front of their home fans.
So you're saying they dropped this one?
No, I think they win this one. And I did have the Warriors at 5 before the series, and I'm not.
Yes, you did.
I am not budging from that prediction. I mean, if they obviously if they lose game four, I will be wrong. But if they win game four, I don't see them going back to Oracle and dropping a closeout game at home. Sarah, has your prediction, your series prediction, changed at all after these first three games?
I don't like to change my prediction. I don't know why. I just like to stick with it. All along, I thought 5 was the smart pick.
Yeah.
It still feels like 5 to me, but yeah, I'm going to stay with 6. I should say that I do think what Cleveland did, they can do again. Like, it wasn't that drastic. I mean, the pick and rolls that they went through, the switching defense they need to keep up, posting LeBron at the elbow, Kyrie being aggressive, like, all of that, it's not that big a deal. Like, they can do that again. Now, the question is, are Steph and Clay going to keep looking like they look? That's the bigger question to me. And we figure they probably won't. But, yeah, so. Now, I'm just going to stick with 6, though, because I'm crazy like that.
That's a good point.
So, Brian, did you hear that? Like, I'm not changing my predictions. Yeah. Like, she just took the high road. Like, yeah, I know what you did, Morton. Mm-hmm. Yep. I saw. I'm not going to do that. Nope.
It's the smart thing to do, though. I mean, you see how it's going, and you're like, okay, yeah, it's probably 5.
I see how it's going. They just lost by 30.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the Warriors, though.
Exactly, right? Yeah. That's really where it is. Like, this team, I mean, there's really no doubt, in my mind at least, that they're going to win this series.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be the defending champions again, they are too. They're on the verge of becoming this dynasty, right? They could run off like 4 championships in a row.
See, I don't know about that.
Oh, interesting.
I think someone on Bleacher Report, I think it was Dan Favale on Bleacher Report, wrote a story about how this offseason is really pivotal for them, win or lose, and a lot of it comes down to their bench depth. They just have a lot of guys who are free agents.
Yeah.
I think it was like Barbosa, Spates. I think Livingston signed for one more year.
I have it right here. It's Spates, Barbosa, Brandon Rush, Isili, Barnes, Ian Clark, then James McAdoo, but who cares?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Sorry, James. But,
right. So,
and then Anderson Varejao.
Oh, God. That he's really just... I'm convinced he is a saboteur for Cleveland. Every time he plays, things just go in Cleveland's favor. But yeah, that Barnes, Azili, Spates, Barbosa, those guys are all important. So
that matters.
I mean, yeah. So, I mean, in game one, the difference was the depth. The bench outscored Cleveland's bench 45-10. It was a 15-point game. So if the bench doesn't go nuclear, like, Steph and Clay haven't played well. Like, it very easily could have been 2-1 in Cleveland's favor with a game four at home. So, you know, between that and the possibility of a Kevin Love trade kind of rounding out Cleveland's roster next year, the possibility of OKC getting another 3-and-D wing and just, I mean, developing. Like, they have so many young guys, like Steven Adams with a whole nother year of development, and the pressure of a KD, Westbrook, and Ibaka all becoming free agents at the same time. Like, I'm not convinced that we're going for a three-peat next year, but I'm with you, Morton. I do think they, even if they don't win it in five, I'd be very surprised if they lost the series.
Yeah. I mean, that would be historic, right? At this point, I mean, with that roster and a 73-win team losing, oh man, I can't even comprehend it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that's the case. But it's an interesting thing about the Dubs free agency. We're going to do a podcast on, we should do a podcast on that.
Like, oh, for sure. Because, we will.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Leandro Barbosa is going to stick around. He's 33 after all. Mm-hmm. I think you can get him for cheap. And if not, you can actually find a shooter who's younger and may actually extend the life of the bench.
Right. That's true.
Who knows?
Yeah. We will tackle both Cleveland and Golden State's off seasons. Once the finals have wrapped up.
Bye bye, Kevin Love.
Yeah. All right, so that was a good finals preview. We've all got the Dubs in game four, Dubs taking the series still. We're going to turn our attention now to our new segment called Storytime with Uncle Mort, because Morton missed the last podcast. He was busy gallivanting with Andre Drummond. So, Uncle Mort, tell us about your time with Andre.
Oh, first of all, such a waste of money. I went, I live in Copenhagen, and he was going to be at an event in Odense, which is about 100 or so miles away. And I had to get a hotel there and the train there, and it cost a little bit more than I probably could afford. But so be it. I thought, you know, Andre was going to be at an event. And it was pretty cool. I hung out with him for 3 days. Didn't really speak to him because I had a media pass, and his publicist or whatever said, like, no media whatsoever. And I learned that on the very first day I was there. I was like, okay, so I can't even, I can't ask the guy any questions. Nope. Okay. So we're both sitting in the VIP lounge, like 5 feet next to each other for 3 straight days. Like, I don't think anyone has spent as much time with Andre Drummond as I have without even talking to the man. Like, really. And I couldn't ask him a damn question. It was like, okay, well, fair enough, so be it. But I got to give Andre some props, though. He was so good. He was really, he took so much time with the kids. He had a lot of fun. And it was genuine, because I was sitting right there with him. And he said several times that he was having a good time and enjoying himself to, like, his inner crowd. Like, he wouldn't do that if he didn't have that. And he was like, unprovokedly, he took, like, out his phone and took pictures and videos of you know, random kids that shot jump shots and competition stuff and whatever. He really enjoyed it and was just so good and patient and signed autographs and high-fived with the kids. It was really great. The one thing, and Brian, I mean, you remember this, I Skyped you on my phone from the hotel, and I was red as a tomato because I'd been outside. It'd been like 90 degrees or whatever, and Sarah, don't you dare laugh at me because I know you're used to much more than that. You were teasing me afterwards. That's not nice. But yeah, I was red as a tomato. I was like, Brian, you know, Andre's a free agent. Look what he, you know, you got to hear what he did. And he was doing this celebrity game with a bunch of Danish celebs, or I wouldn't even call them that, whatever. And he was doing a bunch of dunks, and that on the surface sounds okay, right? But remember the Paul George injury with the Team USA? Like, the basket, the whole stanchion there was like a foot closer to the baseline, or I don't know how long it was, but here in this setup, it was like less than a feet, like less than half a feet away from the actual baseline. Like, the stanchion of the court had no empty area under the basket. It was just like the basket and then one big stanchion right there. And he came down, and this was outside on asphalt and whatever. And he came running down, and he just took off, right? And he had some very nice dunks, but he had so much speed on that if he had landed wrongly at one point, that would have gone horribly wrong. And then one point, the dude tries to dunk, like put the ball between his legs and dunk afterwards. And you know how when you do it successfully, both your legs are up in the air. They're both bent and up in the air.
Yeah.
All right. Thank God his dunk attempt failed very early because it allowed his right leg to stay extended so he could land on it. But if he hadn't, he would have slammed himself with a lot of speed, mind you, straight into the stanchion.
Oh.
It was like the whole crowd was like, ooh, when he did that. I got chills down my spine. I was like, and the first thing I thought was like, okay, there goes 100 million.
Yeah.
Like, that was, I mean, look, all respect to Andre Drummond for wanting to put on a show for the kids. I cannot at any way, like, complain about it. I'm not even complaining about the dunk attempt. It's just, I was caught by surprise that he was willing to do that.
Yeah.
When he was a restricted free agent.
His agent must have had a heart attack if he was there at the time.
Yeah. Like, jeez. I was very surprised to see that. I thought he was, like, going to go easy. And he did for, like, the most part of this game. He took, like, three-pointers and whatever. And just, like, you know, hit, stuck back a little bit, you know, took some jump shots. And then he just decided to say, well, screw this. I'm going to dunk on people. I'm going to go all out. But when he did that, though, I sat there up in the VIP section. I had a good look at it. And I was like, no. I was really concerned on his behalf. So Pistons fans out there, don't worry. He's fine. I don't know what he's doing in France right now. But if you hear about a torn ACL or whatever, yeah, it's probably because he tried to do that. And let's hope that's not the case. Knocks on wood. But wow, that was like, I don't think I've ever seen that happen from like a restricted free agent or just a free agent in general, especially one that young. It was like, wow, you dare do that right now? Because he was running full speed, man.
Yeah, he robbed you of the chance of like the biggest breaking scoop of the year.
I'm glad he did that though, but yeah, that's true. Jesus, I would have gone to like 10K followers if I'd posted that on Twitter. But you know, I am so glad that that didn't happen. I'm perfectly satisfied with my lowly 600, if that's it. Because Warren, I'm just glad that nothing happened.
Could you tell us where you were sitting again?
The VIP lounge.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think I said that a couple of minutes ago. Yeah, that was nice.
I love it, man. Plug it.
Yeah.
Put it out there.
Free soda, man. Woo!
Very important. I love
the thought of like, yeah, you and Andre Drummond just chilling in this VIP lounge.
See, you know, it was so surreal. It was like I went back to this really horrible hotel. It had no air condition, by the way, and it had just been baking in the sun all day. So when I came in there, it was like 38 degrees Celsius. I'm not sure what that is in Fahrenheit.
I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, probably 100 or something.
Yeah,
yeah, very hot. And it was just so horrible. I had to take like 5 cold showers in the course of the evening just to keep cold. And it was like this. I sat there in this really shitty hotel room, and like the day after, like, okay, I'm gonna go down and see Andre Drummond and sit next to Andre Drummond again. Like, okay, and I did that for 3 straight days. Like, went down to the harbor because it was near a harbor, and like just sat down next to Andre Drummond and knew that I couldn't ask him a goddamn thing. That was like, okay. It was a very surreal moment.
I was gonna say, it had to be surreal.
Yeah,
yeah, very surreal. Here's the thing: he's 6'10", 6'11". And he really wasn't that big when you know, he stood next to you. What really caught me was the length of his legs and arms. Like, his arms are so long, he could actually scratch his own ankles, you would think, like standing up, right? It's really that when he got into, like, a defensive stance as well, and you could see it close up, you kind of understand the height. Like, it's not his height per se, it's just the length. And he covers so much ground when he runs. I mean, not under the Kumpo style, but he, for a center, he covers more ground than you would think. And I haven't really paid a whole lot of attention to it when seeing the Pistons, but I'm sure as hell gonna pay attention to it this year because, wow, my goodness. But yeah, it was fun. Like, overall, good guy Dre. I really appreciated that. I thought he was gonna be like one of these sulky NBA stars, thinking this was beneath him, whatever, but then I was reminded he's 22, so he enjoyed the hell out of it. And oh yeah, I forgot to mention, and it's because I wasn't there, apparently Friday and Saturday night he went to like a local place, like a local club, and then he spun records for 2 hours. And he just went up and he was DJing like in downtown at a club for, you know, for two nights straight. And I was sitting here in my goddamn hotel room. I didn't know about it. And I would sure as hell have been there had I known about it. And I would have taken some great pictures. So yeah, Andre Drummond was like the DJ, the basketball player, the star, the everything that weekend. And yeah, it was kind of fun, man.
There you go. We just got a first-hand glimpse into Andre Drummond's time in Copenhagen. I can't even imagine. People there at that club must have been so confused when they see this, like, 7-foot dude walking in and spinning records.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the one thing that annoyed me. I wanted to be there so I could see people's reactions to it. Like, I mean, you know, everyone knew that he was coming to the town because it was plastered on posters.
Oh, okay, you know? Okay.
But still, like, could you just imagine him going in? And I think the club was even called the Gym, which is pretty fitting, right? So, and then he just started apparently spinning records, and I saw some videos of it, and he was having a grand old time. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, and I also overheard his Danish security team. They spoke like internally, and I was standing next to some sort of tent setup they had going. And they were just talking about how cool this guy was, like, to work with. He was so professional and listened to everyone. It's like, it really left everyone with a very good taste in their mouths that his visit had been there. It was really positive all around. So good for him. Good for the NBA. I mean, great setup. It was just, it couldn't have gone smoother. Just ignoring the mist under the legs dunk,
right? Aside from the almost broken leg, things were great.
Almost broken leg.
All right, well, that was a good story time, Uncle Mort. You gotta get back out there and get us some more intel on the NBA in Europe crowd.
Yeah, next year, baby.
Yeah,
just think, we get like one star here, or just one NBA player. Last year was Robert Horry. It was like, okay, hi Robert. So many players, or so many people were like, did you play once? It was like, yeah, okay.
You can go to Turkey. Go check out Dario Saric. Tell me how he's doing.
Hey, I will. Will you PayPal me?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, sure. Good. All right, cool.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us here at the NBA Podcast presented by B-Ball Breakdown. Check us out on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can also find us on SoundCloud and on iTunes. So please check us out there. Leave us reviews. You can find us at B-Ball Breakdown as well. Check out bballbreakdown.com for plenty of playoff coverage. We've got a bunch of reaction to every finals game going up. We've got some good previews as well. Our off-season coverage and our draft coverage is starting to ramp up as well. Next time around, we're going to have Jeff Fairer of bballbreakdown.com for some draft talk. So keep an eye out for that in the coming days. Until then, guys, we will enjoy game 4 and we'll talk soon.
We will, Brian. And thank you for remembering the iTunes thing. You didn't even know we had an iTunes going. Like,
I did not. But now I know. So I will be shamelessly promoting it. Yep.
Wow.
All right, guys. Take care.
Likewise, Brian.